the short distance or the high energy singularities in the free field theory. And on the example of the simple example of the product of two field operators, I show that in fact this short distance behavior can be organized into operator product expansion, namely an expansion of products of operator in terms of local operators. And we shall use this expansion to analyze the nature of the singularities in the interacting phi-4 theory today and see how to get rid of those singularities in a consistent theory. So first, I would like to make a remark. Yesterday, I was considering the divergence of the propagator, namely of the expectation values of products of two fields like that, but considered as operator, namely inserted. So I was interested in the how this behaves when it's inserted in a time order product of many, many operators. Evaluated, for instance, between the vacuum state, because that's the way to construct all the matrix elements of this operator. Okay, and I was interested in what was going on when the modulus, when the square of this space-time vector was going to zero. And you can say that, in fact, of course, you have singularities when this goes to zero, but this defines only the light cone. This is time. This is space. And this singularity, in fact, is a singularity around the light cone. But that's what I will be interested is not really what's happening on the light cone. It's what's happening here. And the reason is the following. What's happening on the light cone is a causal singularity. It's a causal singularity. When there are singularities of the propagator on the light cone, it means simply it's a consequence of the fact that these operators phi of x and phi of y commutes if they are separated by space, if they are in a space-like region, and they don't commute when they are in the time light cone, for instance. So those are singularities which are related to the causal structure of the quantum theory. And in particular, if you meet a singularity when you go from the space-like region to the timeline, to the time-like cone, that's a singularity which you know how to deal with it because you deal with it with a plus I epsilon prescription in the definition of the Feynman propagator. So you know how the propagator is defined here with this I epsilon prescription. You know how it behaves in the past and the future. Okay, but here the singularity is different because if you go to imaginary time, so Euclidean time, okay, this is Euclidean time, this is x, then of course the propagator is just invariant under rotation. You have no light cone, but you still have a divergence at the origin. You still have a singularity at short distance in R4, in the four-dimensional Euclidean space. And it is this singularity I am interested in because that's the part where there is an ultraviolet singularity. And this would mean in all the following that, in fact, it doesn't make much difference in discussing the structure of ultraviolet divergence and of the renormalization process in real time or in Euclidean time. Because the structure of the theory, as far as the high energy or the short distance behavior, is the same. Because it means that you can analyze it in the on a time on a space-like region or on a time-like region, and so the behavior will be the same. Once you know how it behaves here, maybe how it behaves here, you know how it behaves here. Okay. So in most of the calculations I will be presenting today, I will work in Euclidean time because that's a simpler case where you have no I factor. And, okay. But keep in mind that to analyze the ultraviolet singularities of the theory, analyzing it in real time or in Euclidean time will lead to the same results. It's the same thing. I'm not considering two different theories from that point of view. Okay. Okay, so now let us come back to the free field for the first quarter of an hour. We have seen that in general, we expect that if we have two operators, OA of Y, and those two operators goes to the same point, we expect that in fact there is a structure where you have a sum over all possible operators, OC of Z, times some coefficient CAB of X and Y. So these are operators. These are coefficients. So they are functions of the two points. And those are singular, and they behave like X minus Y, roughly speaking, with some exponent, which is related to the dimension of the operators. You see? And that's the Wilson operator product. So we did that for the simple case of 2 phi. And we saw that the leading term is associated to the operator identity here. And we get here a coefficient which is just x minus y to the power 2 minus the dimension of space-time, namely. So we get that phi, let us write it in short on the way, phi behaves like x minus y to the power 2 minus the dimension of space-time times the operator identity. It's short. Short notation for that. Okay. Pardon?
Do you want the second O to be B rather than A?
The second O to be, oh, I'm sorry, it's B. Yeah. Yes, so that's 5x. Okay. So, but we have seen then that we can, in fact, define through this procedure more complicated operators, which are what I called normal products of operator. In fact, the operator phi squared is considered, appears as a subleading term here, which is 1. 1 now is a function times this product. And then we got other products. So you see that, in fact, what I've been doing by constructing such products of operator is, in fact, I did it through the Wilson operator product expansion by looking at the various coefficients of this expansion. And the various coefficient of this expansion defines the operators, the more complicated operators. OK, so now, so we have seen that we can define in that way, we can build in that way an operator phi squared, an operator phi to the 4, et cetera. So let us now check that there is an operator product expansion for the operator, the composite operator, phi 4 of x, and well, for simplicity, I will be considering phi 4 of y. So I take those two operators, and I wonder what is the operator product expansion when x and y come close together. Ah, okay, and you can play the same game, because now we have a phi 4 operator, so I will write this phi 4 of x like that. This means phi 4 of x. This means a phi 4 of y here, that's the point y. And I want to compute this expectation value of this operator in a function when I have many, many phi's. So I want to compute this object. Okay, so this means this is the same notation that I used yesterday. So here you have a phi, and the fact that I have 4 little legs here means that it's, I'm sorry, this was an x and it was a y. This means that this is a phi 4 operator and not a phi operator, which I will denote by, for instance. That's, yes, I'm still in the free field. Still in the free theory. And I will use that to build the interactive theory. So now, if you count.
Question.
Yes?
How come we don't get a singularity within one of those? I mean, why? Because we now have
when
4 x.
Yes?
So I mean, that involves there being Phi-x multiplied by Phi-fx.
Yes, but I have already taken here the normal product I defined yesterday. So this operator is well-defined. It's a normal product of 4 phi, but it's an operator which is well-defined. Okay. And now I am taking the products of 2 operators which have been defined by this normal product description. Okay, so check and apply the Vick theorem and see what's happening in this theorem. So you may have several kinds of contribution. First, you have a contribution when all the files here are connected to all the files. Remember that since we are taking normal products of C4, we are not allowed to make this such a diagram is forbidden, correct? Remember, such a diagram is forbidden because of the normal order. But I can still have that because there are different points. Okay, so I can have that. Then I can have a diagram like that. Something here, it's connected to one of the files, and then I have this. Okay, then I have this, where I can have 2 files connected to some of the. Okay, and then I can have this. I have 1 file. And then I can have the diagrams where this, all the files are connected to the. Okay, so these are the. You have 5 different kinds of contribution. Okay. And you see that this contribution, you can view it as. Well, this will generate some function times the operator identity. This will generate a product of 2 phi, but now the phi are not allowed to be connected together, times the coefficient. So you see, so this, let us draw it in orange. These terms correspond to the coefficient. Some coefficient in the operator product function. Here also. Okay. Here also. And here there is a function which is the identity. It's not. There is a function which is. Okay. And so you see that this coefficient, you can remove. It's decoupled from the operator. It plays the role of a coefficient. And what are the associated coefficients? The associated coefficient here is just the identity operator. So the coefficient is O. It's the identity operator. Here, what is the operator? It's an operator where we have 2 phi which are not allowed anymore to be connected by propagators. So this is the operator. Normal product phi. What is this one? It's a normal product of 4 phi. See, what is this one? It's a normal product. 6 phi, and what is this one? It's a normal product of 8 phi. Okay? So, you see that now starts to be interesting because you generate more complicated operator out of the 5-4 operator. Okay. But what is interesting also is the coefficient. So you see that 5, 4 to the 4, you have something which is this coefficient. So this coefficient, there is a coefficient times the operator 1. Then there is a coefficient here, which is the operator 5 squared. And you see, for instance, that what is this coefficient? This coefficient is a product of 2 propagators, or 3 propagators. Let us write the propagator. This will be the Feynman propagator, but I will. I will denote it G naught just to remind you that this is a propagator in the free theory. Okay, so it's a massless propagator for the theory of mass. Okay, so this here I have a coefficient which is g naught of x minus y squared. And then I have an operator which is phi 4. I omit the fact that it's located at z. And then, but then of course you have, you can expand you can make a Taylor expansion, so you get something like in particular, you will get an x minus y squared 2 times the operator, which is the square of 2 derivatives of phi. When doing the Taylor expansion around z of the operator when you have removed the coefficient. And then this coefficient is, of course, so this is, there is a factor 3 here. You have 3 propagators. And here you have a g naught x minus y squared times 5 to the 4 plus some higher derivatives. Then you have this other operator. And, well, when discussing the renormalization of the theory, both those terms and this term will be involved. But let us concentrate on this term, because that's the one I will have to discuss in this lecture. Let us discuss this term. Now you have to be a little bit careful because you have to compute exactly what is this coefficient. So this coefficient has to be proportional to the product of 2 propagators. But when applying the Lick theorem, you have different ways to obtain the same diagram out of contracting some of the phi here with some of the phi here. So you have some number in front of it. And what is this number? It's quite easy to compute it. Because basically, what you have to do here, you have to choose 2 out of the 4. Which give you a factor of 6, no,
so
12.
Yes,
6.
6.
2 out of
2.
2 out of, yes. 2 out of, yeah, no, you're right. It's 2 out of 6. It's 6. 2 out of 6 is 6. And then you have to choose how to you make you pair this one and this one with this one, and you have 2 ways to do that. Because once you have chosen, you choose one, and you choose whether you pair it with this one and this one. So you have 6 times 6 times 2, which is 72. So in fact, the coefficient in the operator product expansion between 5-4, 5-4, and 5-4 is 72 times the square of the Feynman propagator. You see? And now you remark something. Remember that the propagator behaves like x minus y to the power 2 minus d. So let us come back to the 4-dimensional space. So let us consider that we are in d equal 4. That's a case of interest for high energy. Okay. Then you see that this behaves like so I get something like 5 to the 4 times 5 to the 4 equal sum over something. And here I have the coefficient which behaves like x minus y to the power minus 4, because the propagator behaves like x minus y to the power minus 2 short distance times 5 to the 4. Okay, so I rewrite that factor of normal order propagator. So you see, this is basically this is how the coefficient of the operator product expansion behaves at short distance. And it has the right dimension, because remember that phi to the 4 has phi as dimension 1 in terms of momentum. So this has, so 5 to the 4 has dimension 4. So this has dimension 8 in terms of momenta. This has dimension 4. So this must have dimension 4 in terms of momenta. So this must behave like x minus y to the power minus 4. You see? Okay. But now you see that there will be a problem. This coefficient will lead to a problem, ultraviolet problem, in perturbation theory. For the phi 4 theory. Because we have seen that when making the perturbative expansion for the lambda phi 4 to the 4th, for the g phi to the 4th theory, we are expanding this theory around starting from the free theory. And therefore, we had to compute expectation value of, we had to compute in the expectation value. The vacuum of that, and sometimes we add d x1 phi 4 x1 d x2 phi 4 x2, etc. So we had compute object like that. And what? If I don't discuss why, in fact, I have to consider normal order operator instead of the operator I started from in perturbation theory, then you see that at some point you have to compute the short distance behavior of the product of those two operators, and you have to integrate over the distance. So somewhere in this big integral, you have integrals of the form d4z, let us say, let us call z the difference between the two points, times the product of those propagators, so z to the power minus 4. You see? And this is, of course, logarithmically divergent. So you have short distance divergence hidden in all the amplitudes you have to compute in perturbation theory. And these are new terms compared to what I've been considering when I started to discuss perturbation theory. I show that there were divergences like that, but basically those divergences are related to the singularities in defining the five square operator. So that's something which I expect to be simple to deal with by a little redefinition of what the operator are. This is something new. Okay? And that's a more serious problem because it's a logarithmic divergence, and logarithms are more complicated to deal with. But the fact that there are divergences contains also a solution. Because you see that those divergences are proportional to the phi 4 operator itself. Those divergences are proportional to the phi 4 operator itself. So in fact, when you start to insert integrals of phi 4 operators in the theory, you get problems, but those problems are proportional to the insertion of some phi to the 4 operator. So in a very vague way at the moment, you expect that by redefining what is the coupling constant of the theory, you might expect to absorb those singular terms in a redefinition of the term which is in front of the phi 4 theory in the action. And that's the basic idea of renormalization. Okay, so that's very vague at the moment, but now I will discuss that by an explicit calculation at first order in perturbation theory and show how this vague idea, which is based on the fact that the ultraviolet singularities in theory are proportional to the operator we started from when doing perturbation theory, I will show how it works. Yes?
The G naught cube term. Just,
Okay. So this term is more serious, of course, because it's diverged like x minus y to the power minus 6. In fact, it's a more much more annoying term. And you are perfectly right. The point is that these terms involve, you see, the divergent terms, the singularity comes from this diagram. The singularity here this term comes from this diagram. And that's a two loop diagram. Why? This is a one loop diagram. And remember that I stated without proof last week that when you are doing perturbation theory, doing perturbation theory in the coupling constant or doing perturbation theory in the H bar is the same things. And basically, that a diagram with n loops enters in the term of order g to the power of the number of loops. So this diagram, in fact, will play a role when looking at the first order term in the coupling constant. In perturbation theory, while these diagrams will enter in the second order in perturbation theory. So you are perfectly right, these terms have to be dealt with, and it's a problem, but I will not have to consider it as leading order in perturbation theory. So these terms occur at order, this term will be something of order O of h bar squared, while this term will be tangent at order O of h bar or O of g. Okay. Good. Okay. So now, once I have been doing this calculation, now I will be using this idea to analyze the singularities in the 5-4 system. So. Let us see this for one moment. And I don't need that anymore. And let us come back to the action. So I start from the action of the interacting theory, which is B for x, 1/2. This was d mu phi, d mu phi square plus 2 squared phi squared plus g for phi. Okay. And here I am assuming that I am in Euclidean time, so that there are plus signs everywhere. Okay. Yes. So this is the action, and I am discussing here. Okay, and I compute, I am considering the quantized quantity as in Euclidean time. So what I will be doing is I will look at the quantity I've been defining last week, which is called the effective action, because effective action gamma of phi. And I will consider it at first order in the coupling constant, which means that at one at first order, in fact, in the perturbative expansion, namely in order of order of the h bar. Okay. And the reason why I shall be interested in the effective action is that it's something which is simpler to calculate than the correlation function of the series, the green functions. But you can reconstruct from the effective action the green functions, the connected green function, and then the green function. So if you have shown, for example, that you can define an effective action without any short distance singularity, you are sure that you can go back and reconstruct the connected green function and then the connected function and therefore the S matrix element, for instance, out of the general formalism of quantum field theory. So if I succeed in building an effective action which has no singularities, I know that I have computed, I have constructed a theory which is consistent. So we have seen that the effective action at first order, we have shown we have shown that this effective action is a function of now a classical field phi, which is the background field. And this is the action, S of phi, of the classical action, plus h bar over 2, the trace of an operator. And this operator was minus the Laplacian plus s squared plus, and the derivative, so the derivative was g over 2 times pi squared. Okay? This was the general formula. One loop. Okay? And we have seen, and you have seen in the tutorial, what this trace logarithm of an operator means, and in particular, how you can expand it in power of the complete constant. So we shall be interested into two terms. We shall be interested into the term of order, the term of order 2 in phi, which is called the two-point computation. You have a new single function. And we shall be interested into the term of order 4. And that's, in fact, the term which contains problems with the short distance. So what is the term of order 2? The term of order 2 of phi is the sum of two terms. The classical term, which is this one. Okay, so let me write the term of order 2. The term of order 2 is, so I can write it in the following way. I can, this is integral over d4x, one half of d mu phi, d phi plus m squared over 2 phi squared, plus, and then I have the trace of the logarithm. And what is the trace of the logarithm? We have seen that we can write this as, this is the term which is of order g. So this is, you have a term which is of the form plus h bar over 2. There is a g over 2. And this is trace of, when I expand the trace in power of g, I get the trace of this operator times the inverse of this operator, which I can write as d4x, 1 over minus Laplacian plus m squared, so the kernel of this integral operator between the point x, times phi4x. So this is what means this term. Okay? And this represents nothing but the diagram, which the tadpole diagram I have written. So I can rewrite this term as simply, let us write it in that. We write it as one half integral over d4x, d4y, phi of x. I write it as a kernel operator. You have manipulated integral kernels of operator, but I will do it once again. This is minus m squared, the kernel of this operator, so it's a factor of one half here, and plus h bar g over 2 times this operator, phi squared of x. But the phi squared of x is 1, so this is the operator 1, between the point x and some point y, times phi of y. Okay, that's another way to write what is this operator. Okay, I'm sorry, this is not g over 2, there is g over 2 times this integral, these terms. That's how we write it, how we represent it by this propagator. You see? Times phi of y. So as usual, I consider that this and there is a dx, dy, so what this means is just that this object here represents one of the kernel of the inverse of this operator, namely the propagator, at all ceiling points, xx,
So this is simply the integral d4 k over k squared plus m squared. Okay? Which contains an ultraviolet divergence, which is ill-defined. Okay? So let us define this as the irreducible two-point function. Okay, so you see. So I expand at second order the effective action, and I write it as 1/2 of phi of x, some integral kernel of some operators times phi of y. This object is the integral kernel of this operator, minus the Laplacian, plus the identity operator times m squared plus h bar g over 2 times this integral, which contains some short distance singularity. Okay? Okay? Now, in a similar way, I can look at what is the term over the 4. And let us do it here because I will need Lagrange for analyzing the short distance singularity. So let us write now the term over the 4. The term of order 4 in 5. So the term of order 4 in 5 will be, there will be two terms. There will be these terms coming from the classical action, yes? And there will be the terms coming from the expansion, the term of order 2 in the expansion with respect to g, because when you expand to order 2, you have 2 times phi squared. So the term of order 4, I will write it I will do it in the following way. I will write it as 1 over factorial 4 times integral over d4x g by 4 of x. Okay? That's one way. Then I have a plus h bar over 2 times, and then I expand the propagator, so I get a factor minus, I have a factor g divided 2 squared. I have a factor minus 1/2 coming from the expansion to second order of a logarithm of something plus something. And then I have something which I will write like this. This is d4x, d4y, phi squared of x, phi squared of y, and times the products of two propagators. So this is that I represent by this diagram, x, y. This is simply g naught of, this is simply 1 over minus Laplacian plus m squared between x and y squared. Okay, that's coming from the expansion of this term. Okay, so you see that here you have four operators, and here you have a four five field, and let us call this. So let us write this in a bit strange way. I will write this as d4x1, d4x4. I assume that all the phi are different. I write phi of x1, phi of x2, phi of x3, phi of x4. And then I write a big kernel, which now depends on the 4 points, x1, x2, x3, x4. Okay. And you see that this kernel here, in fact, is just, so this kernel G4 is gamma 4 is just the sum of G times, there will be a delta function, 3 delta functions, so that all the X are at the same point. And here you have, in fact, for this term, you have 2 delta functions because X1 has to be equal to X2 and X3 has to be equal to X4, or X1 has to be equal to X3 and X2. Before, etc. So that's another way to write this. And So, and now we have a force for this object that I write here. I think this work simply means 1 over the propagator, x y squared. OK? Good. OK. So, and now you see where this term is singular because this term is divergent. And this term is also singular because there is a singularity here. When x goes to y, when you do this integral, there will be a singularity. So this term contains a logarithmic divergence, and this term contains a divergence proportional, which is a quadratic divergence. So this term is logarithmic divergence. This term gives a log of logarithmic divergence when you integrate over x and y, and this term gives a divergence in this integral. Okay, so now, and so the question is, how do we manage to make sense out of this theory? One last point, instead of working in real space, in position space, here and here, I will work in Fourier transform because that's simple. So instead of considering gamma 2 of x and y, I will consider the Fourier transform of x. So that's easier. So I will consider what is the Fourier transform of this object, gamma 2 hat of x and y. And let us call this of x1 and of x2, if you prefer, because I have x1, x2, x1, x2. The Fourier transform is a function of the two momenta. Okay? And of course, this kernel is the invariant under translation. This kernel will be a 2 pi to the power of the dimension times the delta function of p1 plus p2. This comes from translation invariance. And then I have a function which is simply the Fourier transform of this object. So this is p squared plus m squared. And then the Fourier transform of this, which is also a constant function. So this is h bar over 2g times this data. OK? Now, if I consider what is the Fourier transform of this object, which is given by the sum of phi 4, this and this, what do I get? I get that gamma 4 of, now I have 4 momenta, p1, p2, p3, p4. Here, I have a sum of, I have translation invariance, and the fact that it's a product of the 4 momenta means, in fact, that simply I have here a delta function for the sum of the momenta. I have 2 pi to the power of d times delta 2, delta d of p1 plus p2 plus p3 plus p4. And I have now this g term, which I write by g. And then I have the minus, so now let us check that here I have a 1 over factorial, and here I have 1 half. So here I have a factor, in fact, compared to factor in this 1 over 4, I will have, if I take into account everything, I end up with a minus h bar g over 2 times the contribution of 3 diagrams. I have the Fourier transform of these diagrams, where here the momenta which enter are p1 and p2, p3 and p4, plus three other contributions. I have the contribution of this momenta, where P1 enters here, P2 enters here, P3 enters here, and P4 enters here. And then a contribution of the diagram where P1 and P2 enters here, but P3, P3 enters here, and P4 enters here. So basically, I have three times the same contribution. Well, now these diagrams, you know, these diagrams depend on x and y. So let us call this, I of x minus y. And I draw this little diagram to remember that this is the Feynman amplitude associated to this diagram. And well, this represents, in fact, just this object represents an object like that, where I have a momenta P1, P2, P3, and P4 entering here with the delta function, which means that the P1 plus P2 is equal to minus P3 plus P4. This represents simply the Fourier transform of this diagram. This is the Fourier transform of function of P1 plus P2. So you take, this is a function of x minus y. You take its Fourier transform. It's a function of one single momenta. But here I choose as a momenta P1 plus P2. Here I choose as a momenta P1 plus P3. And here I choose as a momenta P1 plus P4.
So the first
yes.
Gamma 1, that's a function of P1 and P2. So
yes, gamma of 2.
Right, and yes. That's a Fourier transform of the original expression, which is supposedly a function of x1 and x2, right?
Yes.
I kind of fail to see how.
That's simply because I use the following result. I use the fact that. I use the fact that I can write d4x of phi squared of x as d4p of phi hat of p, phi hat of minus p. That's the general formula for Fourier transform, which is called the Parseval identity. Then I can rewrite this as d4p1, d4p2, phi hat of p1, phi hat of p2, times delta 4 phi 1.
Here I am doing the same trick.
So that's standard trick on Fourier transform.
Okay. Have this h bar g over 2. Should that g be squared?
Pardon?
You have h bar g over 2. Is that g squared?
It's g squared, yes. Okay. This is, of course, g squared, because this is the term of order g, and this is the term of order g squared. And that's a term of order g squared. So you have a term of order g per vertex, and this is a term associated to this vertex in the perturbative expansion. And those are the terms associated to those Feynman diagrams which have two vertices. Yes. Okay. Pardon?
Factor 1 over 4 factorial as a. Is there a factor 1 over 4 factorial as a?
I took the factor of 1 over factorial 4 out of everything.
Okay.
So, and you can check that it's right. Because here you have, here I have a factor 1 over 2 to the power of 4, which is 1 over 16. Okay? But I am divided by factorial 4, so I am here at 1 over factorial 4. Yes?
So, sorry, where did they come from, the delta functions?
Well, in the same way that here the delta function come from this case, and you can repeat the trick. You can write E4 with x of phi 4 of x as D4 P1, D4, P2, D4, P3, D4, P4 of delta 4 of P1 plus P2 plus P3 plus P4 of phi hat P1, phi hat P2, phi out of p3, phi out of p4, with a factor of 2, phi, or p4. Yeah. You can use the same trick twice, okay. And you get this. So, but simply the fact that the Fourier transform of the delta function in of this one single delta function in momentum space is a delta function where all the points have to stay together in a real space. And you can check that by an explicit calculation. Yes?
Yes, I'm going to go back to this equation you have on the center of the board here.
Yes.
I'm curious, you've gone from integral over dx to integral over dx dy.
Yes.
Is there supposed to be a delta function in that integral there?
In this kernel, there is a delta function here. These terms give you a delta function of x minus x1 minus x2. Uh-huh. OK? And what I am saying is also, well, another way to say that is that if you compute the Fourier transform of the delta function with respect to those two variables, you get this delta function with respect to the conjugate momentum. The Fourier transform of this delta kernel is this delta function. Yes?
So the variable that the Fourier transform this gamma 2 here,
yes.
Does that include this Fourier transform?
No, I am considering simply the Fourier transform of this kernel. And what I am saying here is that in fact this is, you can rewrite this also as one half of d4 p1, d4 p2 divided by 2 pi to the power 4, 2 pi to the power 4, phi hat of p1, phi hat of p2, times this function. Okay? You see. So I'm rewriting, I can write this as a kernel in real space, as the kernel is given by this function, or I can write this as an expression, which is a convolution of a function in Fourier transform times a kernel. Now the kernel sleeps in a momentum space, and this kernel in momentum space is a Fourier transform of this kernel in real space, and is given by this formula.
But over there, to get that delta function out, you have to use the fact that you had those phis.
I have to use the fact that I am integrating the.
You use the fact that these phis were there to get that 2 pi and the delta.
Yes, but that's a definition of a phi. It's just from my definition of the Fourier transform, which is I started at the beginning, which is that d4, the Fourier transform. If I have a function phi of x, then its Fourier transform is defined d4p is dx exponential minus I p times x phi of x. And with this definition, phi of x is integral d4p. 2 pi to the power of E I dx. I have P. And with this definition, you have 2 pi here and you have 2 pi here. OK? This comes from the normalization of the Fourier transform I choose at the beginning of the lecture. OK. OK. So I hope now all the points of normalization and definition are clear. So it's easier to walk about this expression in Fourier space because they become much simpler. You have a delta function, which is a conservation of momentum, which comes from the invariance under translation. And then you have a simple expression when you have three times the same function, simply expressed in terms of different variables. OK. So once we have done that, I will consider those expressions first. So remember that this is the Fourier transform of the kernel associated to the term of order in the effective action with two fields.
And this is the Fourier transform of the kernel giving you the term with 4 field in the effective action. Okay? That's all what we need.
Okay.
So, so I have no time to discuss all renormalization today, but that's not. Okay, so now this is full of ultraviolet divergence because this term is divergent, and you see also that this term is divergent here because this term is a Fourier transform of a product of two propagators. So the Fourier transform of a product of two functions is what is called the convolution of two functions. So in fact, this object is given by integral over the momenta, some momenta q with 2π4. And it's the convolution of those two objects. So it's the convolution of one propagator. Remember that the propagator is here, q squared plus m squared. Convolution with that means that I had q to this p1 plus p2. So this is q1 q plus p1 plus p2 squared plus m squared. So this function is given by this integral over an internal over some extent momenta of a product of two propagators, the propagator with momenta q and the propagator with shifted momenta q plus p1 plus p2. Okay. And you will recognize, in fact, the fact that in the language of the quantum field theory, this is the propagator of a one particle which propagates with momentum q. This is the propagator of one particle which propagates, well, let us write it the momenta in that way. So this is the momenta minus q. This is the propagator of a particle which propagates with momenta q plus p1 plus p2. Okay. So this diagram, in fact, represents the amplitudes. If you have two particles with momenta p1 plus p2 which enters here, they interact here. They become one particle with momenta q plus p1 plus p2, and one particle with momentum minus q. And this satisfies the conservation of momenta in the interaction of particles. They propagate for some time, then they interact again, and they become a particle with momenta minus p3 and minus p4. So this is how the interaction when you have two particles which collide, interact, collide again. Of course, that's a virtual process in quantum space, because if you have two particles interact, they cannot interact again, but these are quantum particles, they have wave functions. And so this is how the two process quantum particles. And in this process, since it's a quantum process, energy is not conserved. And therefore, this momenta here may be very large. See? So you have a process where you have an intermediate state with high momentum q, a quadri momentum. So it has a high energy and it may have a high momentum. And you see that what's happening here, that this integral is divergent when q is very large. This integral is divergent. Because I have d4q divided by q4, q squared, and q squared. So this integral is ultraviolet divergent. And that just reflects the fact that this integral is a Fourier transform of a product of two propagators, which are become singular when they come close together. See? Then I can have higher. So this is another way to see how ultraviolet singularity arise in this calculation. Here I view it in real space. Here I'm viewing it in moment in space. But I'm looking at the same singularity in two different ways, in real space, in moment in space. Okay. Okay, so now, so once I have analyzed this divergence, so you see that there is a logarithmic divergence, and here there is a quadratic divergence because this integral diverges in a very nasty way. So now let us see how we can define a sensible theory. So first I will look at the renormalization for massless. Why am I interested in the massless theory? Well, most quantum field theory have massless of almost massless particles. Of course, the photon is massless, but if you view the quantum field theory for a very high energy, all the particles have very, very small mass. Quarks are not so large masses, which is the U and the up and down quark. The electron has a small mass, neutrinos have very small mass, and one of the big problems in high energy physics is to understand why the mass of many particles are very small compared to other ones. But anyway, I will be first interested in what's happening to the massless. So I want to see, I want to start from a theory which has mass n equal to zero. Okay. So if I start from the theory where the mass m is equal to zero, let us consider this two-point function, this term. Okay. You see that the two-point function as a function of the momentum p, if I get rid of this delta function, which is trivial, it's p squared, then it's p squared. Okay, and that's it at three level. So you see that the fact that the theory is massless means that in fact the irreducible two-point function has a zero at p equals zero. It's p squared, so it's zero when p squared is equal to zero, and the mass of the particle in fact is the mass of the excitation of the particle is simply given by the well-known mass shell condition. It is quite clear that mass shell condition means that the physical mass of the particle, the physical mass of an excitation, is given by the condition that the two-point function at p squared plus mass of p is equal to zero when p squared equals minus m physical squared. Remember that I'm working in a minus plus 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 signature, if I'm here, I say. So p squared is minus the energy, or P0 if you want, plus the momentum. So this means that this condition means that the P squared equals P squared plus M squared. Okay. So I want to construct a theory such that the mass is zero, namely I want that the two-point part. The two-point irreducible function is zero when p is equal to zero. You see, that this is satisfied when at the order of the classical theory, but this is no more satisfied when the theory is interacting, or when quantum effects are taken into account, because you get a correction to this, and not only that, but you get a quantum correction to the mass of the particle. But this correction is positive, that's fine. Quantum correction increases the mass of excitation. But it is infinite.
Is that error? You see? Okay. Because this is h bar g over 2 times this d4 k. Let us write this function t of m, t for a tadpole, this is a tadpole graph. So this is a function t of 0, which is infinite. Problem is that t of 0 is infinite. But now, imagine that you have changed the theory so that you introduce an ultraviolet regulator so that the momenta here are always smaller than this ultraviolet regulator. So you have some maximal momenta, you have changed the theory so that the theory makes sense at high energy, because basically you cut all the momenta at high energy. I won't explain at that level how I do that. There are rigorous ways to do that, but at that level, I just say that the theory is a little bit changed at high energy, so that these integrals have to be cut off when the momenta are larger than the big scale. So lambda is large, it's very large. And I try to make sense to the theory at scales, at momenta, which are much smaller than this big scale. Okay. And in fact, in the real world, there is such a scale. Such a scale is provided by the Planck mass, because we know that at the Planck mass, physics must change. We don't know yet very well what it is. Some people have a lot of ideas, and all of them right. But what you should mean is that basically you should think of a quantum theory as a theory which is valid up to the Planckian energies. After that, perhaps it's still a quantum theory, but of a different nature with a lot of different degrees of freedom. Perhaps it's not anymore quantum theory, it's something we have no idea about. But basically, we are allowed to do quantum theory for all the degrees of freedom of the fields which have momenta smaller than the Planck mass. Okay? So we have to cut off everything at the Planck mass and say, after that, I don't know what's happening. So I suppose that I have a theory which is defined at the Planck mass, and now I am starting to study it at lower energies. Okay. And I am trying to make sense of the theory at higher energy level from something which I assume exists at the scale of this regulator. I don't know very well what it is, but I assume it exists at least at the scale lambda, and I'm going to look at what's happening at momenta or energy smaller than lambda. And in that case, of course, T naught becomes integral d4k over 2 pi to the 4 1 over k squared for momenta less than lambda. So this makes sense. And this is of order lambda squared with some coefficient. And the coefficient depends, of course, on the way you have defined exactly how you regulate. But if I take a sharp cutoff like that, this is simply 1 over 32 pi squared. But this coefficient won't be very important because it depends on the regulator. If I choose 2 lambda instead of lambda, of course, this coefficient here is in fact regulator dependent. Okay? And now we have a solution of our problem. Because if instead of starting from a theory with mass n equals 0, I start with the theory mass squared can equal zero, let's say. I start with the theory with mass squared equal minus h bar g over 2 t0, namely of the order of minus h bar g over 2 lambda squared. You see? So this is something which is very large in the regulator, but it's very small with respect to the coupling constant. And I'm doing perturbation theory in the coupling constant. And when I am doing that, so if I do that, I end up, so let me call this the renormalized, the bare mass square. For this bare mass. Okay. If I do this, then
so mass is an imaginary. So mass is an imaginary.
The mass is imaginary, but yes. So it's sometimes it's some kind of pattern. But that's remember that. Now I am considering a theory where I have a theory with a potential which is m phi squared, 1/2, plus g over 4 phi 4. Okay. So the mass here may very well be negative, because this term is positive, so I have a field like that. Okay. And so if the mass is negative, the field as a minima, so I have a symmetry broken phase, the quantum level, with phi squared of the order of m squared divided by g. See. Now, if I take for this to be the bare mass, phi squared is of order, then the phi squared at the scale lambda is of the order m squared, which means if I have a minus c, let us look here. If I have this will be of order h bar g lambda squared divided by 2 times when the well here I assume that h bar is equal to 0 everywhere, so I will get a factor. So this means simply that I have a renormalized. So in phi is finite. The expectation value of phi at the level of when I'm looking at excitation, when k is of order lambda, is of order the momentum. And that's in agreement with the fact that the phi has dimension 1. You see? So there are the field at this level gets wide quantum fluctuation and gets trapped. Okay. But it's still controlled by this momentum. This momentum controls what's happening at high momenta, and it's controlling, in particular, the fluctuation, the quantum fluctuation of the field. You see? And now, if you start to look at what's happening at smaller momenta, then you have quantum fluctuation which starts to develop. And what I'm computing is the effective action. So what I'm computing here is the effective potential. And if I start from a potential which at this scale is trapped here, there are quantum fluctuation which makes it tunnel in those two vacuum. And at the scales I am interested here, the effective potential will be like that. And therefore, it may very well be the effective mass, what is called the renormalized mass of the theory, the physical mass of the theory, is the curvature of the effective potential here. So the bare mass is the curvature of the effective potential, and it's very large and, in fact, negative here. So you have to start from a situation like that.
in order to have a physical mass at our scales, which is small. You see? So everything is consistent. See? Okay. So once I've been doing that,
sorry?
Yes?
Just a little bit confused. On the bottom you wrote mass squared equals lambda squared, which is equal to the bare mass, and then up on the top line you wrote bare mass plus So on the bottom you wrote that this lambda squared term was equal to the bare mass squared.
Here?
Yeah. And then, but on the top, you adding the bare mass squared to the
t of 0. No, that's, now I change. I start. Sorry, okay, let me explain. And then I will stop there. I want that. We don't have to normalize the shooting constant and properties, but we'll do it next time. So, if instead of that, so I start from an. I start naively by doing, in order to get a theory with a mass which is zero, I start from an action which is 1/2 of d phi squared plus g over 4 phi to the 4. I start from this theory. And then I discover that this theory is full of ultraviolet divergence. And in particular, the mass of the series is very large and is of the order of the ultraviolet regulator.
And you want it to be zero.
But now I say that if instead of starting from this action, I start from an action when I have that. So if instead of starting from this action, I start from an action which is this plus delta S, delta S is given by h bar g over 2 the minus sign lambda squared pi squared. And this is called the counter term. Then the theory such that the physical mass is finite first, so it's all order order 1 in terms of the regulator, and moreover the physical mass zero, so they have adjusted. D'accord? So that the physical mass is zero. So in order to get a theory whose physical mass is zero, I need to start in the path integral formalism by a theory which is described at scales or the lambda by a theory with a mass of a negative mass squared given by this coefficient. So this is the bare mass and the physical mass is equal to zero. Yes?
Just to confirm, the physical mass is by
the physical mass is defined by the point where the two-point function is zero. Okay? And in fact, something I think I said briefly last time, but you must, there is a general relation, which is that the propagator is the interacting theory. When I'm computing the propagator in the interacting theory, 5y, which is the full propagator of x minus y, full propagator, the full green function in the interacting theory, if you take its Fourier transform, g hat of p, it's simply given by 1 over the irreducible function, two-point function. That's a general feature which comes from just the diagrammatic. So
stating that the irreducible function as a fold at some as a zero at some momenta means that the Green function has a pole here. So the physical mass means that as a pole at p squared equal minus m squared. So it's equivalent to state that the physical mass is defined by the zero in the irreducible two-point function, and to state that the physical mass is defined by the pole in the two-point function, because one is the inverse of the other. And that's the usual definition. Okay. So I think that, as I said, I have to stop. But I hope you have get an idea. This is the first simple example of normalization. We have seen that in order to define a theory which such that the two-point function makes sense, so and such that it has no ultraviolet dimensions, and such that its physical mass is equal to zero, you have to start from a theory where such that its action in the functional integral, so the thing you plug in the functional integral in order to try to define to compute Green function, must not be the classical action in theory, but it must be the classical action modified by a counter term. And this counter term is divergent when the regulator goes to infinity, so it's a very, very large term. But if you choose it well, you manage so that the two-point function is finite, because then the two-point function with this action, starting from the action S plus delta S, you get a two-point function of P, which is just P squared plus term of order h bar squared. So at two loop, you will have to do this game again. But at one loop, you manage to define a theory which has a physical mass which is finite and which has a physical mass equal to zero. And that's basically the idea which is behind the renormalization procedure. Okay? And this is something which is very, very physical. This is often presented, well, it was not anymore, but in the 50s, renormalization, and the 60s, renormalization was viewed by many, many people, including many, many great physicists, as very suspicious, because it looked like some kind of black magic. You have infinities, you subtract infinities, and you get something finite. But this is something really physical, because in a quantum theory, all what you need to do is to compute expectation values of operators in the vacuum, because you need to define observables, which are operators, and you need to define states, so that you compute matrix elements of those operators, those observables, between the state of the theory, the physical state. And this has to be finite. And that's it. Now, how you compute them is up to you. And one way to compute them is to use path integral, for instance. And in order to use path integral, you need to plug some action. But this action doesn't need to be finite in the continuum limit. All what you need is that the physical quantities, which are the matrix element of observable between physical state of the theory, have to be finite, because that's all what's all what you need to define a consistent quantum theory.
But yes? Isn't it going to depend on the choice of lambda and the physical quantities?
Here, you see, it doesn't depend on lambda, because I've seen that for any lambda, I can choose a counter term so that the speed theory, that the two-point function is independent of lambda. And in fact, this will be true for the other point function. This will be independent on lambda, at least in the limit lambda goes to infinity. You can Here, the result is exact because it's very, very simple.
So this counter term that you've chosen is appropriate only for a massless scalar field.
This counter term is appropriate for a massless theory. And we shall see what that when we try to define a massive theory, but with a physical mass, which is finite, we shall have to modify this counter term. And that's not unexpected.
If I understand correctly, we take a massless theory, and then to make it work, we plug in this counter term.
Yes.
Add it. We ad hoc just put it in.
Yes.
Because there is no physical reason other than to take the infinities out for which this counter term.
The mathematical reason is to take out the infinity. The physical reason is to have a theory with a mass equal to zero. And that's a physical requirement. I want to construct a quantum theory with zero mass. Okay? That's that. I observe in nature that I have some phenomena which are explained by a quantum theory with massless particles. So there are bosons instead of photons, but I have massless bosons which propagates at the speed of light. So and I want to build a theory of that.
So we construct
I want to construct a quantum theory of interacting bosons, massless bosons, which propagates at the speed of light. Okay? So I start to say, haha, but I have Mr. Feynman invented the path integral. It works very nice for a lot of theories. So let us try to compute the theory, which at the end gives me a theory of massless bosons.
I just have one more question. Is this choice of counter term unique? Can we construct this same theory of massless thing with a different counter term?
Here you see no, because you see that if I start from a theory, I have to choose the counter term to be equal to this one, so that this is the other counter term cancels this one. So this choice of counter term is unique. And you will see tomorrow that in the general case when I will be considering also the coupling constant, so it will be unique. Once you specify what you want to obtain at the end, so you want to specify what is the physical mass, you want to specify what is the effective coupling constant, but there is a subset here because you have to define how you measure the coupling constant. But if you define a procedure to measure what is the coupling constant between your particle, the physical coupling constant, then the counter term will be unique. Okay, so I have to stop there. But so next time, tomorrow, we shall deal with the renormalization of coupling constant, and you will see that something very, very interesting happens, which will lead to renormalization.